ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is John Fitzgerald, the founder of Cause Cinema, with 20 years experience in independent film, internet, and film festival communities. As a filmmaker for Cause Pictures, John has produced many documentaries. And as a consultant, he's guided many independent film projects through the maze of festivals and hybrid distribution models. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Excited to be here.
I'd like to start back a bit to the start of your career. Could you tell us about Slam Dance and how it got started?
Sure. I guess I should start at the very beginning, which is when I met the two other guys, Dan Mervish and Shane Kuhn. We all had projects at the IFFM in New York, which was kind of the big indie film market back in the day. And I was visiting a friend in New York a few months later, when all the announcements were starting to be made about getting into Sundance. And we didn't get in. I got a call from Dan. The first call said, "We're going to have a screw Sundance party. Are you in?" I said, "Sure." And he called me back the next day and he said, "You know what? We're going to just go up and screen our films anyway. Are you in?" I said, "Sure." And then the last call was, "Shane went to school in Utah, and we think we might be able to put on our own festival and screen some films at the University of Utah, which is in Salt Lake. So maybe we should just do that." So, of course, I said, "Sure." So that's kind of where it started. And three of us kind of just wore different hats. Dan was I don't know if he's a journalism major, but he certainly had the tool set for it. And he was really good at writing press releases and got a cover story in Variety. I had a nice space in my kitchen for the office, and I was probably the most organized of the three of us. So I took on kind of a lot of the organizational work. Yeah, so, you know, the short version is we went into Salt Lake screening movies at the school. We ended up with, I think, 10 films, all by first-time directors. And the whole idea was, let's generate exposure for another bunch of filmmakers that we all felt deserved to be in Park City and didn't make the cut. Fortunately for us, it happened to be one of the years where Sundance had started receiving some negative publicity and people were talking about how political it had become to get in. And there was a little bit of a backlash in the media. And so we kind of accidentally became a bit of a Cinderella story without even really trying. You know, about halfway through the week, we weren't getting the attendance that we thought we might get. So we literally just moved up into Park City and rented a screening room down the hall in Prospector Square from one of the other Sundance screenings. So we literally were running our own projectors and we had signs up on the hallway saying, you know, come see a free movie. And so we took a lot of the fallout. We filled our screenings with people that couldn't get into the Sundance movies. It was a lot of fun and we got a lot of exposure for our movies. Not a lot of films got acquired necessarily, but we had some pretty strong filmmakers. And of course, we all did it to promote our own movies. Wasn't really to start a new film festival that would be an ongoing affair. But like I said, the office was in my kitchen. And after the festival was over, the phone was ringing off the hook with filmmakers saying, "Hey, that was really cool. Are you guys going to go back?" So I took on the leadership role as the executive director and mounted the charge. And Peter Baxter, who had a film as a producer in the first year's festival, agreed to come on and help as a creative director. So that's really kind of how it got started. And then it just kind of took off.
So did you have any idea what you were getting into and the work involved when you started?
I wouldn't say I had no idea, just because I had been to film festivals before. Mm-hmm. I did kind of have a sense for what film festivals were all about. I certainly didn't know about the actual production tasks, but it didn't take long to figure that out. And I think the truth is, it kind of played a bit into my producerial sensibilities, if you will. I mean, it's similar in a way to making a movie. There's a lot of prep, mm-hmm. and you're gearing up and you're crewing up and you're creating accounts and creating materials and creating a look. And then you go up and you make the movie. In this case, you go up and you do the event and then you wrap it out. So I think I certainly didn't know everything I needed to know, but I did catch on pretty quickly because I think I have kind of strong producer skills. I'm much better at producing than I am at directing, quite honestly.
So after Slam Dance, you then moved to AFI. What prompted that move?
Well, it was a couple things. The first most important was, I was kind of tired of living in a rent-controlled apartment making a couple hundred dollars a week. It was kind of nice to have a consistent salary, mm-hmm. which AFI actually offered me.
Funnily and enough,
Well, it helps. It helps to be able to pay the bills and stop eating, pasta and eating tacos. But that was part of it. The other part of it was I had done it for 3 years and I knew I was going to retain co-founder status. Frankly, having AFI's brand in your back pocket, it made a difference. And I knew that I'd have a bigger budget to play with. I knew I could do more with the festival. And I knew, having been to that festival, that there was a lot of room for growth.
Right.
And, it was a really long, it was over 2 weeks, mostly international films, very stodgy and kind of tame, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I brought in some American indie sections and brought in some sponsorships, maybe put together an advisory board, mm-hmm. I knew it wouldn't be that hard to raise the bar.
Right.
And I think they had an older gentleman who had been running it for many years, and I think they just wanted some fresh blood. And I was excited to get in there and roll up my sleeves with a bigger canvas and a bigger budget.
So all of this was before high-speed internet was widely available, before YouTube, before Facebook, before social media. How did you get the word out? What were the ways in which you connected with people?
It's a great question. Actually, the old-fashioned way for the most part, because it was the AFI and because they had a new director, we generated kind of a lot of publicity for that. And mm-hmm. they had something to finally talk about. And I benefited from that. So we got a lot of coverage in the local papers. But I think the biggest thing that we did on an outreach strategy is really leverage new relationships with sponsors. They didn't have a sponsorship program to speak of. They had, black and white type on white paper, and it was just not the way to generate sponsorships. And I knew that from the work that I had done at Slam Dance. Mm-hmm. I learned kind of by trial by fire, right? I had to figure out how to raise money. And so I knew that if we created some interesting packages, again, with the AFI's brand, that we could really generate some positive relationships and sponsorships that frankly would help get the word out. So it wasn't just about, going to the DGA and the Writers Guild and AT&T and going to some of these new partners and bringing them on board. It was, how can you help us get the word out? So for example, with Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, they put our posters and our guide in their windows, and their path and our passes were around their staff's neck. And right. Our guides were distributed all over town at their stores. Back in the day, we're talking 97 here, so this is a while ago, but they had, there was a bookstore called Borders Books and Music. I don't know if you guys have it out there, or had it.
Yeah,
but, but they did a whole presentation in the store around film-related books, had our posters hanging from the rafters, and again, staff wearing our badges. They did a huge piece in their newsletter that went out to thousands of people. So we got really creative with our partners to really help get the word out. And that was a big difference for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that today, with the reliance on social media, that people are not maybe taking some of those really in-person creative approaches that they once did? Because that is a real activation. That's a real experience you're creating. And have people sort of, now, are they just putting all their eggs in the social basket and missing some of these interesting opportunities because they don't have to, because creativity is often born of limits?
Yeah, that's a brilliant point. And I think the truth of the matter is there's a little bit of both, and probably less traditional, or I guess if you want to call sponsorship outreach traditional, probably less in that bucket than in the social media bucket than before. And I'll be honest with you, I'm still trying to learn the social media thing. I mean, I'm smart enough to know that that's where it's at, and you have to go down that path. But I like getting creative with partners and finding out how to leverage, you know, whether it's creative and art or music or, you know, color schemes. I'm into all that. I think that's part of the fun, is getting creative. And the social media is more about photos and pinging people. And it's a different formula for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think people can tend to get lazy.
Right, right. Jumping forward in time, you've guided many film projects through festivals and the ever-changing distribution models. And looking back, if you were to find a common thread or unifying trend, what would it be? And do you see any new trends on the horizon? Or do you believe that current things are simply going to become more amplified?
Well, that's a lot of questions in one, so I'll tackle one at a time. But I think there's no doubt that, you know, there's always been an avenue to share your personal vision with independent storytellers, whether it's a story that's close to them personally or it's a category that resonates with them that they feel like they can tackle. And I think with making an independent film, it's always been a stepping stone for a lot of filmmakers. You know, it's an opportunity to do something that's not going to, you know, break the bank. It's not going to take you 10 years to make, for the most part. And if you can show your talent, and specifically, you know, back to the festival game, if you can play film festivals and generate some credibility, maybe even win some awards, that's an opportunity for agents to sign you, distributors to acquire you, or at least keep you on the radar. So I think that is a constant that won't change. I do think that, you know, another thing that won't change quickly is that filmmakers have to continue to be resourceful. I think the barrier of entry is lower. People can make films now. I mean, Steven Soderbergh just made his last movie with an iPhone. I mean, you can make movies now a lot easier. And you know, the flip side is there's a lot more bad movies getting made and being submitted to film festivals. So the competition's greater, but I still think you have to be resourceful. And I remember reading Rebel Without a Crew. I don't know if you ever read that, but the Robert Rodriguez story. And, you know, when he did El Mariachi for whatever it was, under 15 grand, you know, he had to be really careful about what props and what elements, what did he have at his disposal to tell that story? Because he didn't have much money. He knew, for example, that he had access to a motorhome. He knew he had access to a turtle. I mean, he knew what he had access to, and he figured out how to weave those elements into his story. And I still think that filmmakers, I think you mentioned earlier, you know, you get more creative when you have limitations. I think that still is true. The other thing that's true is that, and this is a tricky balance, I think, there are a lot of filmmakers that believe that, you know, they're the next Quentin Tarantino or the next Steven Soderbergh. And I think they're going to make the next thriller that's going to be, you know, Blair Witch or Paranormal Activity or whatever. And it's just, the odds are not in your favor to make a, you know, lightning in a bottle. And I think that it's a tricky dance, because you want to be confident in your abilities and you want to move forward with some assurance, but at the same time, you got to manage expectations. And so I think that some of those things are consistent. I think one of the big changes is that, and I kind of referred to it earlier about the iPhone, you know, when I made my film in the mid 90s, you know, I shot on 16 millimeter because I couldn't afford 35. And a lot of filmmakers are making films in 35 millimeter. And it was really expensive to mm-hmm. get that done. And then to have it transferred so you could, you know, output the DVDs and now you've got the internet and digital. It just doesn't have to be film anymore. And it's a major savings, and it's much more efficient today than it used to be. But I do think that, you know, again, the other side of the double-edged sword here is that now you're seeing more filmmakers make movies that quite honestly might need more.
Well, maybe if they had to come up with resources, they would have been more selective in their story and the choices they made. That by having ease, it meant that they were sloppy or lazy.
Yeah, or they jump into something before they're ready. I mean, I'm the first to admit, my first movie, if I was a programmer at Sundance, I would not have invited my movie either. Bottom line. And I'm man enough to admit it. It wasn't a great movie. I thought I was ready, and I think I did a good job. I mean, it did okay. It was in some festivals and won some awards, but at the end of the day, I probably wasn't ready. I didn't have enough money at the time to do some of the really interesting camera moves I would have done. And I think if you're going to make a movie without a lot of money and it's a character piece, how are you going to make it amazing? I mean, if you don't write dialogue like Aaron Sorkin or Quentin Tarantino, you know, how do you make it interesting visually? And I think that's something that filmmakers can often forget. I mean, you can be Whit Stillman and, you know, Metropolitan. I mean, how amazing was that movie? Oh. But not everybody can write like that.
Right. That was a great movie. That was a great movie. So you started Cause Cinema. Can you tell us a little bit about it and why you identified this as white space in the marketplace?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that documentaries as a genre are on the rise. Mm-hmm. It's definitely the hottest category at most festivals. And I would like to believe that thanks to Netflix, to some extent, there's a greater awareness of documentary. There's more awareness certainly for non-fest goers. I mean, if you go to a festival, you certainly, most of them have documentaries now and you know about them. But, you know, if you're the average Joe going to see, you know, a broad comedy or the latest Star Wars movie, you might not even know what a documentary is. I think that Netflix has expanded the audience and, in fact, brought people into that space that didn't know it even existed. Mm-hmm. And certainly didn't know that there was a, because the other thing that I'm just about to transition to here is that there's a lot more creative documentaries getting made.
Right.
I think there was a kind of a reputation that documentaries were static and talking heads and big giant history lesson, you know? Right. And I think that you've seen some pretty amazing documentaries over the last 5 or 10 years. And these filmmakers are telling amazing stories. I mean, think of something like The Cove. That was a thriller, you know,
in a
documentary. And so people are seeing these movies more than ever. And I felt like Cause Cinema could be a place to guide for audiences and consumers to find out about which of these movies they could see. Because ultimately, you know, again, back to the double-edged sword with Netflix, for example, they've got documentaries that are truly remarkable, mm-hmm. but they've also got over 100 movies in that documentary carousel. And I would say half of them aren't worth your time.
Right.
And that's just my opinion, but I think that everybody's time is valuable. And I felt like Cause Cinema could fill a void in guiding audiences that were interested in certain categories and certain types of movies and help them find them. And so that was kind of where I started. But the other thing about Cause Cinema that I really hope it grows into is an opportunity for audiences to take action and get involved after seeing the film, kind of right at the source. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go see a documentary in a theater, or you could even see it on Netflix, but Netflix doesn't have a call to action. They don't have anything more than the standard templates that support their movies. So I thought if I could talk about some of the causes that are connected to these movies, that if audiences were engaged and inspired to take action, I would give them that tool to be able to do so. Here's the link. Here's a place you can get involved. You don't have time? What about donating $5?
Right.
Or whatever. So those were the two things that I thought Cause Cinema could do. And I had done enough research to see that there wasn't another company living in that space with that as a resource.
So social impact around this. Now, is it only documentaries, or can narrative films also be social impact films where you would have an activation?
Well, I think you have both. I mean, I have focused a bit more on documentary because it in some ways it's the easier. It's the easier category, and frankly, it's the one that's booming. Mm-hmm. But there's no doubt that narrative still does fit the bill. It just depends on the film. And if you look, for example, you know, you want to look at the history, you think back to, you know, 12 Angry Men, you think of Schindler's List. I mean, there's a long list of Norma Rae. There's a lot of movies that were essentially cause-based movies. They just didn't scream, you know, go take action. And right. I think that if you look at the best pictures nominated today, for example, you got almost half of them, you could make a really strong case. Three Billboards.
Right.
Pretty strong case, right? The Post.
Right.
Dunkirk.
Right.
You could even say darkest hour. Right. I mean, it's less issue-based, perhaps, but it's still socially relevant. So I think that there are a lot of narratives that are made. You think about, you know, 12 Years a Slave. You think about Mudbound. And there's a lot of these movies that do have something to say.
Do all films that have something to say, are they all sort of depressing? Is everything that people have to say, I mean, is this, you know, where you just end up feeling like, oh, the world is a sad, sad place? I mean, do you find uplift in what your source?
Here's the thing. I do think there's no doubt that a lot of these movies, you know, bring up some challenging issues. And some of them are darker than others, for sure. But there's a couple things there. One is that I think that it's important for audiences more than ever to connect with the world around us. I think that there are a lot of issues, whether you want to talk about politics, you want to talk about the environment, you want to talk about food, you want to talk about human rights, whatever the case may be, these issues are out there. And they're front and center now. And I think that when people are concerned about something in their world, it helps them to connect with kind of, you call it entertainment for change, if you want. You know, it's something that you can kind of escape to in a way. It's entertaining, but at the same time, you're actually learning something and connecting to a story. But there are movies that can be inspirational, even though they're bringing up issues. You think there was a documentary a few years ago called Alive Inside about a gentleman who came up with this idea that if you put headphones and music on a patient that was suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia, that they literally came alive. They literally, it was triggering their past and they started smiling and interacting more. And I mean, this is scientifically proven to make a difference now for these people. And so there's a movie that at its core, it's Alzheimer's patients in a home.
That's a little depressing, right?
Which sounds really depressing, right? But you watch this movie and you see these patients coming alive. It's very inspirational. I mean, you were kind of excited to see it. And then there's you know, Starfish Throwers about homeless. But the way the story is told is it takes these characters, some of them I would even call heroes, and shows you what they're doing and the people that are feeding some of these homeless people and the people that are really making a difference for a lot of people's lives. And so, yes, there are some darker issues and stories, but there are some inspiration that can come from these stories.
Right, right. One of the trends that we've identified over the years is the tendency to have content creators really zero in on their audiences and niches. And part of what makes this possible and successful is because of the proliferation of distribution points and platforms that are available to creators. But this is both a boon and a bane for them, because when you have all these different places to be, it becomes a challenge for viewers to discover content. And so it sounds a bit like these filmmakers who are making passion films, it's a bit of a double whammy. It's both a challenging path, but it's also, and they're inexperienced filmmakers typically, if this is their first foray, because this is a passion project. Is part of your role helping them navigate this, or are you really a resource that once they've already got together, they come to you?
Well, I've definitely done both. I certainly think that, you know, back to the earlier part of your question, I think it's really important for any filmmaker, I don't care what your budget is and how much experience you have, I think it's really important to know that you have an audience before you, you know, take that leap into the project. And I think, you know, if you're making an independent film, chances are it's not what they call a four quadrant movie, right? It's not like a movie that's going to appeal to every demographic. Mm-hmm. So who is your target audience? Is there one? You know, is your movie about basket weaving, or is it a social issue movie about a specific category of the environment? I mean, if you think about it, you could go to Charity Navigator, for example, and you could search by human rights, veterans, environment, water. I mean, you could search by a gazillion categories and you could find literally hundreds of charities, quote, causes, right, out there that are doing something in a space that you might be pursuing. So are there partners? Are there interested parties? And it's an interesting, again, it's like a two-pronged approach, right? When you're thinking about your movie, is it, can I preach to the choir? Is there an audience that's already looking to hear this?
Right.
And just wants to be reinforced? And then where's the educational side? Where's the group that's susceptible to hearing this, but that may not have heard it, but that would likely respond to it? So right. You got to do both of those things. But when you're developing your movie and your story, you got to think about it. And if you're trying to scrape together a few dollars to go make a movie about the environment, you know, how much time is it going to take you? And what are your expectations? Documentaries typically don't make money. If you're scripting it, is it the kind of thing that you need to raise $2 or $3 million or $5 million for? Or is it something you can do for a couple hundred grand? And is it going to be just another coming of age story of which there are hundreds made and a handful that actually succeed?
Right.
Or is it something really different? So I think you have to know if there's an audience before you really, really jump in and think about the creative partnership possibilities. That really helps to answer your questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know you covered a lot in that question, but in terms of what I typically do is I try and help people think about their goals before they start. If they've already finished their movie and they're playing festivals or they need help on their festival strategies, again, what's your goal?
Mm-hmm.
Some filmmakers just want to travel the world and get feedback on their movie. Some only want to play industry festivals where they might get acquired.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
very different profile. Those two people, I would imagine.
Yeah. And some people have day jobs. You know, I did a movie a few years ago called The Milky Way about breastfeeding in America. And the two producers are lactation consultants. They couldn't just disappear and, you know, take their movie all over the world. I mean, they had jobs, or at least one of them did. So you have to know your limitations and know what your expectations are and really think about what is the worst case scenario. And then do as much homework as you can. I mean, the benefit to everything right now, I think, to state the obvious, is that you've got Google now.
Right.
You can learn so much before you even turn on one of your lights or flip the switch on your camera. I mean, there's so much you can learn now. And what else is it? What else has been done? If you've got an idea for a movie, chances are somebody's already made that movie.
Right.
So research it. How many people have made it, and how are you going to differentiate from them?
Well, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think one of the things I'm sometimes surprised about when I meet people is how little research they do, and that it's pretty easy and not everybody does it. Have you found that the people you're coming into contact with generally are buttoned up and have done the research, or are they not, or is it a mix?
It's definitely a mix. It's definitely a mix. I mean, I showed a movie at a festival last year that a gentleman made that was called Holding On. It's an amazing film about teen suicide, which is obviously a pretty big issue today. It's a narrative. It's scripted and it's brilliant. And this guy did his homework. He knew who all the players were in that space. He has a very specific mission and a very specific path, you know, to get that movie out there. And whether it plays on 500 screens or not, we don't know, but it will find an audience because there is an audience and almost everybody's been somehow connected to that subject,
right?
Sadly, personally.
Right, right. How do you avoid hashtagivism, if you will, like the hashtag activism where people have seen the film and they're like, oh yeah, but they don't actually take real action? What are the ways in which your site really connects them to concrete action? Are there direct links to make donations, or does it connect you to organizations? What does your site do that makes it more concrete?
Well, I think the intention, I mean, it is a new company and we're just right. going out for a big fundraise now. And so we haven't actualized the vision in every sense of the word. But what it should do is it should have different opportunities for audiences to connect and take action if there is an issue that is actionable. Because again, some of these movies are socially relevant because they educate you or they share an idea for you, but there is no specific cause that filmmaker can connect you to that says, you know, here's where you can make a donation, or here's where you can get involved. Come down the street and, you know, serve food to the homeless if you want next week. Some of them are more obvious than others, but I think the key is that if you're taken by the issue, then there should be a way for you to get involved somehow. And again, some people are more interested in making a donation because they don't have a lot of time. So there'll be a donate button and it'll just click right through to the donation. I don't, you know, cause doesn't take a piece of it. But some people are really struck by how they could really make a difference and are looking for something to get behind. And maybe it's 2 hours a week, maybe it's 10 hours a week, but there's also a get involved button and they can get involved in that particular cause. So I think that, you know, one of the trickier issues could be if you're dealing with something like veterans. You know, there are hundreds of causes out there for veterans. So how do you
pick the right one?
Yeah. How do we pick the right ones? And I think that's still something that we're working towards. And I, you know, there are companies like Charity Navigator. There's a few others that filter through and kind of tell you, you know, which ones are most transparent and which ones, I mean, sadly, there's a lot of causes out there where the, you know, the executives are making six figure salaries and who knows where the money's going. And I think there are companies that are working through quality control and where's the transparency, and that's something else that we want to be able to do is kind of be that filter for them, be that resource that has done that homework.
So we can trust it.
A trusted source.
Right. Now, one other thing is you've just released the update of your book, Filmmaking for Change. What can readers expect to learn from this book?
Well, I tried to cover all the bases from start to finish. You know, if you take the three main categories, development, production, and distribution, I cover the bases in all those categories. So I do talk about, if you're interested in making a story about human rights, you know, here's where you can look for some ideas. If you're looking to do something on the environment, here are some other places for ideas. I talk about story structure. I really focus a lot on Joseph Campbell's 12 stages of the journey. I try and take the idea around almost narrative storytelling in a way, but putting it into both documentary and narrative structures on a dry erase board for you. You know, you can think about some of the more successful documentaries lately. There is a hero, and that hero does have a call to action, and you know, there's obstacles and there's a conclusion. And I think that that audiences are built, or I should say groomed, to expect a certain type of storytelling that resonates. And I think if you can take social issue movies and put them into these type of narrative flows, I think that it has a greater chance to resonate. And so I try and help on the development side, make sure you're thinking about all those things. And then from a production standpoint, I talk about, you know, I do break down both narrative and documentary. Obviously, narrative, you're scheduling in a tighter time frame, and you know, similar to what studios do. But if you're doing a documentary, is it something you're going to do over a period of years, over a period of weeks? Are you going to take off to India for 30 days? Like, how are you structuring your production? And then with distribution, I focus a lot on the different players in the distribution space now. Obviously, you've got a lot of digital players in addition to the traditional players. And then I talk about the festival circuit and how to really maximize that. But the thing that's new about the second edition is a whole section on activation, and how to create a toolkit and how to create movements and the different companies that are involved in creating change through resources, really. And so that's kind of the general idea around the book. But I should say that when we first did the draft, you know, whatever it was, 5 years ago, it was targeting kind of emerging filmmakers and people out of film school. I think what we're seeing now in the last few years is more kind of what I'd call amateur filmmakers or just kind of the everyman deciding, or every woman, you know, deciding, I have a story I want to tell. And if you look at the movies that I've been working on, I mean, one of them was a yoga instructor. One of them was a nurse. Another was a fitness coach. None of these ladies, as it turned out to be, had any experience in making movies, but they all had a story to tell. And right. So with Filmmaking for Change, they were able to take their ideas and put them into a framework that made sense. and essentially become producers. And, you know, Forks Over Knives is a case study in my book. That guy was a real estate agent, and he decided he wanted to make a movie that could make a difference for people about vegetarianism. And he wanted film to be the medium to do so. So I really want filmmaking for change to be a vehicle that anybody can turn to if they have a story to tell.
That's wonderful. Where can people find out more about you and more about what you're doing?
Well, the two core websites are filmmakingforchange.com, and there you can learn about the book. You can read some sample pages. There's links to different places to buy the book, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble or MWP who published it. And then you can also hear podcasts on Filmmaking for Change, which we just started a few weeks ago, and really loving that. And then my other site, of course, you referenced, is Cause Cinema. So causecinema.com. And Cause Cinema at this point is really doing a couple of things. One is, again, doing, you know, the blogs and the podcast to kind of get the word out about these films. But we're also beginning to essentially create what we're calling Cause Cinema selections for movies that don't necessarily end up in a blog or a podcast, but that we feel like by category, these are the best ones you should see. Again, whether it's food or, you know, on veterans, or it's human rights. We did a thing about Martin Luther King. I mean, there's so many different categories now, but depending on what you're interested in, we want to be able to have different categories that you'll be able to search.
Right, right. Well, thank you so much. This is fantastic. I think what you're doing is really important, and I appreciate that you gave us so much of your time today.
Absolutely. It was fun.
Thank you
for all the great work you do.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, John Fitzgerald. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.